Hi there, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0, and this will be an episode that's very much like Hugo's There 1.0, because we're talking about an award-winning book, and this time it is Vonda McIntyre's The Moon and the Sun, which won the 1998 Nebula Award for Best Novel. My guest is Sarah Elkins, a repeat guest. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And at some point, I think I'm just going to have to promote you from repeat guest to regular contributor. because I think people will have heard the discussion panel written for this episode. So,
right.
But it's nice to have you again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Since this is the first Nebula winner, I did want to talk just a little bit about the Nebulas. I guess technically it is not true that this is the first Nebula winner that I've done. I've done 27 of them. But this is the first one that I've done because it's a Nebula winner and not a Hugo winner. The Nebulas have been awarded since 1966. The nominees and winners are chosen by members of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association. There have actually been some rule changes, and I'll invite people to read the Wikipedia article. But the current rules, as they stand, are nominations are put in by CIFWA, and then the top six nominees make the shortlist, and then they vote on those. And they can't nominate their own work, which makes sense. That's not the way it works with the Hugos. I can tell you from experience. And there are some tiebreakers actually built in. In the past, there were some co-winners of the Nebulas, but now there are tiebreakers based on like number of nominations. And I think that's about it. Anything else you know about the Nebulas?
I had noticed there were some double winners in earlier years. And I thought that was really interesting, but that's about it.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar enough with the list to know, about half of them are co-winners with the Hugo and Nebulas. Mm-hmm. And, it's a professional award, right? Because these are people who work in the industry,
right.
Who work as writers. And so I think you get some things popping up in the Hugo Award that I think are a little more surprising than you get in the Nebulas, just because fans might attach to something that, snobs go, But yeah, so... Talking about the regular format, why don't we start with why this book, Sarah?
So I did read this book back when it came out. I had been wandering through my library and this gleam of gold caught my eye and I wandered over. And at the time, the cover of the book that at the time was called The Moon and the Sun had a beautiful picture of a fountain with strange looking golden sculptures in it. And that caught my eye enough to start looking at it. So I read it back then. I liked it a lot. I was impressed by it. It's a historical fiction set in the court of Louis XIV, hence the fountains, yes. Versailles, hence the cover.
And the title of the book, right?
Sure.
Because he's called the Sun King.
Right? That's right. Yeah. And it imagines, however, it's sort of an alternate fantasy history. It imagines that mermen and mermaids were real. But this isn't some frothy fantasy. It has a lot of darkness and struggle in it, even though it has the glamour, the glitter of court life. It has science and sea monsters, religion, nuanced religion. I'll really look forward to talking about that some more with you, Seth. Societal norms, ethical dilemmas, and there's some music in it. So I am something of a music geek, so I liked that part too. Yeah. So that was fine. I had enjoyed it back then. And then last year, I was really surprised to come across a new review by a popular reviewer who had... decided to trash what to me I remembered as this rich, chewy old book, dismissing it as some kind of weak historical romance. I kind of got the sense that he thought it was just some sort of lifetime achievement award for Vonda McIntyre, who'd already won. Yeah. Hugo's and I think Nebula's before. So I was indignant and I ranted about it to my sister and she said, you should write a blog or go on YouTube or something. So
here we are.
Yeah. So here we are. I have to apologize though, Seth, because I hadn't realized it. It seems to me that they have changed the book some. I think what prompted this negative review after all this time, why pick on this old book, was because a movie version had come out, which I hadn't even realized in 1922. And there's a 2022. And there's a whole story we could get into with that. But it looked to me when I reread it all the way through and compared it to what I remembered and then went and looked at the Wikipedia entry, it looks to me like they changed some of the beginning, some of the ending, maybe a little in between. So I don't think they ruined it. I think it's still a substantial book, but I remember it being a bit of an easier read before. And maybe, maybe other people might like it better this way. But we can talk about that more when we get to the spoiler section. I'm just really surprised that they changed the text of a Nebula winner and they didn't warn anyone. You know, I tried to find an online version of the Moon and the Sun, and I couldn't. I could only I suppose I should have gone and looked for an old print paperback book, but then you wouldn't have read that. So it's just as well that I've read the version that's available now, you know, short of going and finding an old used book in print and ordering that. I think this is the version most people would be able to find. And it's definitely what's available on audio, I think.
And this is one of the things that's a little insidious about ebooks, right? Because because when you own an ebook, you own a license to that ebook, and the publisher can change it anytime they want. And then anytime it syncs, you have a new version of the book. And I still haven't checked this. My friend Colin and I were talking about the Silo series on Apple TV, based on Wool by Hugh Howey, and he swears he went back and reread Wool 1. Actually, I think he read the whole thing. I just read Wool 1. And he said, the beginning of that is different than I remember. And so he wants to go and get the print version of it and see if the ebook has changed. And I don't think it was necessarily changed to fit with the series, but it's possible that it's been revised. And, you know, I have nothing against authors revising their work, right? You can put out a third edition of a book, a second edition.
Oh, sure.
Book. Yeah.
I wonder if... I mean, McIntyre's dead, so I don't know if she approved this edit or not. They didn't change it to fit the movie exactly, because I can tell from watching the movie trailer there are differences between the movie and the current book.
Yeah, there's a skeleton of the book.
Right. So it's odd.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's why I picked it. That's my initial surprised impression having reread it. But now we can get into talking about the book proper. I could give the plot kickoff, maybe not talk about the whole thing, or do you want to say anything first?
No. Plot kickoff sounds good.
Okay, so here's my framing. This is a first contact story gone really, really bad. It's gone so wrong that the civilized people framing the narrative at the center of what they consider they're at the center of the world. You know, it's the French court, Louis XIV, very powerful, very glamorous. They don't even realize what story they're in the middle of, you know, let alone not knowing the science fiction term first contact. They just don't know they don't see what's going on as, you know, what you or I reading this would see as important. This is just some strange thing happening about, you know, it's just an oddity, a novelty. So they know about that there are these legends of sea monsters. The church has said these are just savage beasts. The people at court prefer to focus on their glittery lives at court, and there's a whole lot of competition, and if not literal backstabbing, certainly people willing to, you know, maneuver a lot. And so they're focused on the game as they see it. But gradually, one of the characters starts to realize the harm that's been done and is being done. She starts trying to convince others around her. This does not make her very popular. And they have some idea that merpeople can give you immortality somehow. And they all want that so bad that it kind of warps their beliefs about what's happening and what's going on. You know, so they're in superstition that they're kind of calling science, but it's, you know, they're not recognizing the wonder of other intelligent beings in the world. So, you know, in a lot of first contact novels, there's a sense of wonder. And there's some in this one character who starts to realize things, but everyone around her is like, you know, got to work on getting the right wig for the big ball, for the big banquet coming up. You know, none of that thing with that creature is important. So,
it's interesting because the book is sort of a costume drama in many ways, because there is a lot discussed about people being properly dressed and coiffed and all that kind of stuff. And I do feel like it would be possible for somebody to bounce off of it on that level.
That's right. That's right.
I don't think that makes it a slog in any way, though. It just it kind of deepens the characterization to know what people are thinking about such things.
Right. For me, what this was, I think it was a deliberate choice by McIntyre, and not just like, I want to write a costume drama. I think what she was trying to do was show you what are these people focusing on. Yeah. And, you know, there's the little dog that's annoying, that's the dog of the powerful woman that Marie-Joseph is, our main character, is trying to, keep her happy, because that's her position at court depends on keeping other people happy. And so there's stuff about the dog of this woman that she's trying to take care of, and certainly costume and all of that. And some people are going to be like, why am I reading this? But to me, if you compare that to some books by Sherry, C.J. Sherry and Arkady Martine more recently, where there's all these intricacies of power struggles going on. And boy, in C.J. Sherry, it matters if you can get the captain of the ship real coffee, and
it matters if you know the right poems.
Absolutely. In Martine, can you make classical allusions in Arkady Martine's Hugo winner, A Memory Called Empire? Can you refer back to some poem written 600 years ago? Well, if you can't, then you're just some ignorant savage that no one's going to pay attention to. So to me, this book is kind of like that, in that the people who are immersed in this court, they know what the signals are. They know how to signal. Marie-Joseph and her brother Yves, who are at court, Yves Delacroix, they're at court and they are learning these things.
Right. It's almost first contact for them, too, with the court life.
Yes, right? It's definitely got some culture clash going on there.
Mm-hmm. And Eve is a priest and a naturalist, probably a Jesuit, I imagine. I'm not sure.
Definitely Catholic. I don't follow all the nuances, but he's definitely done, rigorous study. He thinks of himself as a scientist, and he's, read a lot of science stuff, very knowledgeable and smart, but we'll get into the drawbacks of his scientific approach later. So anyway, that's the kickoff, I would say, of where we start getting into things. The drawbacks that some people will bounce off of. Mm-hmm. So I started talking about the main characters. So the book, this version of the book, opens with a short scene with Yves Delacroix, who's a church-trained natural philosopher. They did actually also use the word science in the book, but natural philosopher was also a very common thing. He's from the colonies. I think Martinique.
Martinique, yeah.
And so is his sister, Mademoiselle Marie-Joseph Delacroix, his sister. She's convent trained. Basically, he went off to go do natural philosophy, exploring and traveling and so on, and stuck her in a convent, which did not go well for her. She is convent trained, and she has sketching and musical skills, which the convent discouraged. So she's kind of had 5 years of nothing and then suddenly called to court. But she can sketch well, she can observe well, and she has musical skills from her parents and life before the convent. And then the other we can say there's three or four main characters. Count Lucien is a highly placed courtier. He knows what's what. He's been around. He's paid attention. He is a person with dwarfism. So his position, although he's one of the king's favorites, it's precarious at all times.
Yes.
So one of his agendas, he loves the king. you know, the King Louis XIV, you know, accounts of the time, he was very good at getting people to like him. He had a lot of charm when he wanted to. And so Count Lucien loves the king, but he's hoping that he will repeal the Edict of Nantes. N-A-N-T-E-S, which was a thing that kind of put the ban hammer down on Protestants all over France. And things had been okay until that Edict of Nantes came out that Lucien sees how bad it is for the country. He's actually an atheist, but he sees how bad it is for the country. And he's desperate to have the king keep on living because he doesn't think whoever will come after is going to have any shot, any interest in repealing it. So
he's also trying to arrange his own succession, right?
Yes, he doesn't think his younger brother is going to be any good as being a courtier. Mm-hmm. He thinks he will basically lose his estates, you know, lose the family estates, and he's trying to get his nephew recognized as the heir, which. He's doing it for the good of his district. He does care about his district getting poorer and poorer as these wars go on.
And it's Brittany, right? Where his lands are in Brittany.
Roughly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And then the one you might call the fourth is Sherzad, the sea monster who becomes the, you know, becomes in the narrative the sea woman who then claims the name Sherzad at some point during the story. So those four characters play off each other, but there's a bunch more characters in the book. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, and there's a bunch more characters from French history, like Madame and Monsieur, Monsieur, right?
Yes. The king's brother. I didn't know much about French history when I read this. Mm-hmm. And I read it the first time, in 1998, maybe, and I just read along. Mostly I'd read The Three Musketeers, which comes a little earlier and is not precisely based. In fact, one thing I liked about the edition of this book that I did read, The King's Daughter is the new name of the current version, is at the end on my ebook, there was the list of characters with an asterisk by every character who was a real character in history. And some authors who write historical stuff really do a lot of work to make sure that everything is right in it, as right as they can be, except the secret history or the alternate history that they put in. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to make it as grounded as possible. And this court, certainly for the reading I've done since then, I admired McIntyre more and more, you know, the more I read it this time around, knowing what I know now about French history.
Yeah. So I went back and listened to Emmanuel's episode of Lafayette, We Are Here, about the Sun King. And like, okay, those are real characters. That's neat. So
right. And he just came out with a new episode about Louis XIII and Cardinal Richelieu, which, although those events don't directly happen in this book, it certainly said a lot of what happened when Louis XIV, you know, became, his mother became the regent, you know, et cetera, and on from there. There was a lot that happened in kind of before this story takes place that set up a lot of why the king acts the way he does.
Okay. I'll have to give that a listen. I've been so buried in audiobooks recently that I'm way behind on podcasts.
So some of the points of interest in the book, I mentioned the religious nuance. So one of the characters in this book is the Pope, Pope Innocent at the time. And Marie was at a convent, etc. And there are a lot of negatives on religion in this book. The Pope wants all women to shut up, and he's in favor of warring on the Huguenots. And so on. But there are also some positives on religion, mainly as motivation for characters. So the Pope also is concerned about what a hyper-focus on wealth and display is doing to the people of the French court. He sees them become, obsessed with these vanities. And I think he genuinely is worried about their souls. Mm. And Marie-Joseph, she's partly drawing on her religion. You know, she believes in God. Yeah. She believes that what they're doing to the sea people is wrong, is murder. She argues on that point, even though most people don't agree with her that they're even people. So in her discussions with Count Lucien, who's an atheist, and some of the discussions between some of the other people at court with the Pope about religion, there's a lot of nuance in this book. Mm. There's a character who's a total jerk to Count Lucien because she believes he's touched by evil because he's a dwarf, because at that time many people thought that if you're beautiful, you're good, and if you're ugly, you have, there's something wrong with you. Right. And so she's a total jerk to him, but she's concerned about the money, that, you know, the starvation, the poor. Yeah. And so there's a lot going on with religion, and I really like how McIntyre is showing all these different angles. She's definitely not a black and white writer. Mm-hmm. She definitely wants a little grappling to go on, you know, within the characters and within the reader, I think. Mm-hmm. What did you think about that part of the book, Seth?
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting, the interplay between the different kind of parts of religion. And in the book, you know, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of different people telling Marie-Joseph, shut up, you don't know anything about science. Shut up, you don't know anything about religion, about theology. You know, shut up, you're a woman, mm-hmm. you shouldn't even be talking.
Yes.
And, you know, that comes from both religious and secular sides to her. But, and like you mentioned, Count Lucien is an atheist. And, and you know, he doesn't really strongly object to anyone being religious. It just doesn't, you know, he's none of his motivations are from that direction.
Right.
And he's motivated more by love for his country and for his lands and the king.
Right.
And so, you know, McIntyre doesn't show him as being evil in any way, right? He's in many ways the most good character. And he's even, you know, he has, and this is touching on spoilers, and I feel like, let's just go into spoilers.
It's 1990. It was 1998 when it won the Nebula. Yeah, so yeah, sure.
Yeah. I say we just go right over into spoilers.
Okay, fine.
You know, there's love that begins to brew between him and Marie-Joseph. Mm-hmm. And he understands his own physical limitations. And I mean, he's in constant pain.
Yes.
And I kind of pictured that he had scoliosis. Or like really bad scoliosis that had
maybe
stunted his growth, rather than any form of actual dwarfism. But I think,
thank you. I'm not sure. Okay. The book doesn't give a medical diagnosis.
No,
so my fault for jumping there.
Yeah. I think they do use the word dwarf at some point.
They do, but more as a derisive term than a medical analysis.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, right. It could be scoliosis. Yeah. He's absolutely in constant pain, which I don't think is true of, of everyone who is that size.
The way he is able to endure is his very frequent sexual escapades. He says he's
sex
basically
and
only
his,
and alcohol, right?
Yes, Calvados made from apples from his own homelands.
Oh.
Yes, yes, and touch will distract him from the pain.
Yeah.
And often that means sexual touch.
Right. And
so,
it's France,
him.
So.
Sure.
You know, this is a time when the royal mistress was an actual position.
Oh, yeah.
No pun intended.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
right. The morganatic marriage of Louis XIV and his second wife.
I think there's a nickname given to Lucien's current paramour.
Yes. The court gossips about him having a Madam Past, Madam Present, and a Madam Future.
That's what it was.
And so they keep saying, well, who's Madam Future?
Yes.
Yes.
And here we have Marie-Joseph, who has been convent educated, essentially, that sex is a painful necessity.
Right.
Entirely devoid of any benefit other than the fact that it produces children. And
right.
At some point, he just has enough and says, all right, let me tell you the facts. And lays it out for her that no, this is a good thing. And she's not sure what to make of that. So
I do want to talk a little bit more about her innocence. Mm-hmm. I think it's real. I think it's believable. Yeah. Her whole youth, she was obsessed with science and drawing and helping her brother, who is really into natural creatures. Yeah. He also is not that much into the, you know, frisky times. Right. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Doesn't want to go there. But you know, her youth was spent obsessed with that, you know, drawing and music. That was what she loved to do. She loved helping her brother, looking at things and observing. And and then she went to the convent where they told her every physical thing is bad.
Right. Those are sensual.
You know,
things,
every
right?
physical pleasure is bad. And the world, you know, looking at these creatures is not looking at God, which is certainly not the way some natural philosophers would look at it. But anyway, I found it very believable that she arrived at the King of Louis XIV very innocent, you know, very, very, you know, and I don't mean that as a wonderful, you know, I'm not making a commentary about, you know, wonderful chastity. I'm saying she just didn't know, you know, you could say ignorant and instead
much.
Of innocent. I found that very believable. Some other readers haven't found it believable, but I've read other books, you know, girls or anyone who is brought up really strictly and more or less brainwashed into thinking anything sensual is bad. You know, they're not going to think the same way other people are. And it's not just a pose. It's really your mind just doesn't go there.
I was thinking even of, to say nothing of the dog. I remember there was a moment in that book where Ned tries to refer to a cat being pregnant and gets, you know, gets elbowed in the ribs by Verity.
Polite little, you don't talk about
you
that.
You don't mention pregnancy. What are you doing?
right. What kind of savage are you?
Yeah. we try not to remind people of the realities of that stuff.
Right. Which in a way can be freeing. To not be thinking about that, or to not have to be dealing with it at all the time. There's a thing in one of Bujold's books where Miles' brother Mark is relieved to find out that at this big fancy party there is no chance of sex with any of these beautiful women because, you know, that doesn't happen. These parties are not hookup parties. And he didn't know. He wasn't sure. Yeah. And he feels much more relieved and able to interact with people at this party when he knows that's just not on the table.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. So science.
Yeah. And the history of women contributing to science and then having their contributions brushed to the side.
Yes. So one of the big things there for me was the whole thing about Marie-Joseph being a sketch person. In our own history, in real history, so many women did a whole bunch of naturalist sketching of mushrooms and leaves and animals and fossils and all of that. And routinely, time after time after time, they weren't seen as the scientists, even though they were making detailed observations and wondering and, you know, comparing things. They were doing analysis. Yeah,
they're moving the ball
and
forward.
And yet, they were discounted as assistants to the men, you know, to the real scientists. And that is, you know, McIntyre is not talking about this overtly in the story. What she's doing is showing you that they're all discounting. You know, Marie is clearly a better observer than Eve is because she's able to actually see something, write it down as it is. Yeah. Without making judgment about it, whereas he is like, this is a sketch of a terrible thing, you know, and he throws it in the fire. And she's just trying to show a sketch of the merman who's dead, who's been, you know, the mermaid has arranged some corals and glass and so on around his head because she's trying to give him the best funeral she can, poor thing. She's trapped in a lab with her dead mate. And she tries to give him a display and he throws it away as junk instead of look at the culture of these people, you know.
He does keep that one ring though.
Well, yes. And
that's it's an important one.
And she, Marie-Joseph, you know, she sketched what she saw because she wanted to preserve what what it was instead of. So anyway, she's a better scientist than him, in my opinion. He's better educated. True. But that doesn't mean he's a better scientist.
Yeah. And the purity of the science is record the observation and don't worry about the implication of it, right? Or the theological implications of it. Because she's looking at this this dead merman and saying, that looks like a human skull.
Yes.
And of course, the church has said, no, these are beasts. So it's just, it's more like a chimpanzee skull, you know.
Right. And Eve, her brother, who does have some good points in the book.
He does. I liked him at first. But,
yes. But he's clearly kind of tormented, though he has some reformation at the end. Yeah. But he dismisses her saying, what do you know of skulls? And she's like, there were skulls in the convent. They brought out the skull of the saint. We looked at it. You know, I know what skulls look like. And he's still dismissive of her till Deschartes, another guy who's in the lab, says, that does kind of look like a skull. And Eve says to him, oh, what do you know? You know, you're not a scientist. And Deschartes is like, I have seen many dead bodies and skulls in battlefields. Mm-hmm. You know, which is kind of a real face slap to Eve, who's you know, his status is not up with Deschartes. You know, Deschartes is, for all his terrible flaws in the story, he's a soldier. He's, you know, he's been in bloody battles and he knows what dead people look like and he knows what skulls look like. Yeah. Well, anyway, he asserts that he does. I'm not sure how many literal skulls one sees, but fires, et cetera, you know, it's certainly possible that he had. Yeah. So, but the science, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was thinking about the contributions of women in science. I'm going to be doing a podcast with Daryl Cunningham, who has a series of graphic nonfiction books, and one of them is called Science Tales, and it's just the stories of six scientists, and two of them are women. Mary Anning, who is very important to the discovery of fossils along the English coast.
Yes, yes. I read a whole historical fiction about her, which is another one of these books where I think they tried to stay as close to the record as they could and just filled things in. Very interesting woman. Yeah.
And you know, of course.
And there was also a class issue there, not just sex.
Very much, yeah. And that crosses over gender boundaries, big time. Yes. There are plenty of gentlemen scientists who won't accept contributions from commoners, you know.
That's right.
Regardless of male or female. And then also, I had written it down, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who essentially discovered pulsars. And then when the Nobel Prizes were handed out, she was nowhere to be found on the list.
Right.
And they would not have been discovered at that time without her. She was the one who did the work, who dug through the records. You know, it was the kind of thing where there were sheaves of paper coming out from early radio telescopes. And she was going through these thousands of pages and finding there's a little squiggly here that I can't explain. And it happens at regular intervals.
Right.
And yeah.
Right. Two other names have popped in my head, but that could be a whole different episode. I am really interested in discussions about science and what science is. One of the things in this going on in this book, where again von McIntyre isn't using the words, is there's a paradigm shift. So paradigm is a way you conceptualize the different points of belief that you have. It's kind of a framework or a map.
Yeah. You're talking about the structure of scientific revolution.
Yes, I am, Thomas Kuhn. I absolutely am. And in this, you know, you think you've looked at the evidence and added things up, and you think you know what the deal is. So you don't, if you're the National Science Foundation, you don't want to put a lot of money into something that's ridiculous, you know, babble. You want to put money into things where you can see how, okay, they'll do this research and then they'll either know this or they'll know that. And it's a sensible way to organize scientific research, but it's putting on blinders. Because you will discount evidence if it doesn't fit into your paradigm.
I feel like I've beat this dead horse on all my podcasts.
Theory
and string theory, and the fact that it's kind of the only licit way to talk about grand unification these days. You have a hard time getting funding for other things.
So I'd love to talk about this more, but for now, I will just say that I put a link in my Google Doc to Catherine Asaro's 1999 review. So she's a science fiction writer, and she's also a scientist. You know, okay. I think a physicist. So she did a whole review, a third of which at least is about the science part of this book. And she loved it. And if you're interested in what Seth and I have been talking about, you know, I'll encourage, you know, when this episode comes out, I'll certainly toot the link to Asaro's review. So,
yeah. And, you know, talking about the science leads into the discussion of the nature of the sea monster, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how the sea monster begins to be seen by Marie-Joseph as a woman, right?
Right.
She realizes there's, if not humanity, at least mm-hmm. personhood. She's kind of recognizing that in the sea woman. And she's, of course, able to communicate with the sea woman. No one else is open to it. And I think that is kind of the implication that sort of like in The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Mm-hmm. Lewis, when mm-hmm. Uncle Andrew can't understand the talking animals because he doesn't believe animals can speak.
That's certainly making it harder for him to even take seriously.
Yeah.
You know, this reminds me of the Ancillary Trilogy, where there are the Imperial Roch don't believe that certain local population can't speak their language because they're speaking with an accent.
Right.
And so they're speaking their Imperial Roch and not realizing that all the locals can hear what they say because the locals talk with an accent and they've discounted the locals as
barbarians.
And so that's the kind of thing that'll happen if you have it in your head that they can't possibly be.
Yeah. The line from C.S. Lewis that I always remember about Uncle mm-hmm. Andrew mm-hmm. resisting the idea that these animals are speaking and being able to hear from Aslan, for instance, and C.S. Lewis comments on it, and this is from memory, I didn't write this mm-hmm. down. Now, the trouble about trying to make yourself stupider than you really are is that you very often succeed. And
yes.
And yeah, because Marie-Joseph can understand the kind of musically, right, and mm-hmm. and telepathically. And you get a sense that the common people also see that a little bit.
Right.
But the pretty people, the important people, resist it.
So here's what I think is going on. I don't think that McIntyre was trying to do anything as ethereal as telepathy. Okay. She kept talking several times about the sound that the sea people made. Yes. The sea people communicate roughly, you know, underwater through sounds. Mm-hmm. And the implication is that they can shape things sonarly, sort mm-hmm. of like how, you know, today we can make holographs. We can mm-hmm. make simple holographs. We may be able to make more complex holographs in the future mm-hmm. with light. The idea is that these sea people are making pictures with sound.
Okay.
And she later sees images of a tiger. Marie-Joseph later sees mm-hmm. things that the sea woman is singing to her and trying to warn her, making things through shapings of sounds. Okay. And so, yes, in some ways, I think for maybe because of her musical training, maybe because of her naivete, she's just more open to it than some of the other people. And so I think the book is at least trying to establish something that could be a mechanism for this to be happening rather than it being sheer telepathy.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when she explains that she's able to understand the sea woman, she's taken to be hysterical, which, of course, is a word that literally means, you know, sick,
referring
in the womb.
To women's right or uterus, one of those.
and so then they have to bleed her.
Oh, and that's terrible. And
which then she ends up with an infection, with the treatment for which, of course, is more bleeding.
Right. So yes, the bleeding. There are some cases where bleeding does help a person, but unfortunately, a common misconception is you find out something works great in one case and you start trying to apply it everywhere. You know, yes. I mean, that happens now. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's clearly one thing that was happening then. And of course, it did have the effect that some of the people wanted when they bled her. She became weak and was no longer making yes. her hysterical raving. So clearly, from their perspective, the bleeding yeah. worked. So right, she's infected, and one of the interesting things that happens between Sherzad and Lucien then is Sherzad has something in her saliva that seems to help people. She clearly does licking stuff in a way, and there are, I think, are there some animals that have saliva that's helpful? Anyway, it's certainly imaginable that there might be some healing. Undersea creatures might evolve to have some, you know, to somehow, you know, generate yeah. something that's a good salve or something like that. So she's licking Marie Joseph's arm where she's infected. Lucien brings out this black smudgy thing from his country doc back home that he absolutely right. believes in. He's been in battle. It's helped him. And so he, you know, the sea woman thinks that Lucien has smeared roughly manure on yes. on her arm, and you know, so she hates Lucien and would tear him apart because she thinks he's a bad man, and he thinks this savage, you know, or like a dog trying to lick, you know, blood. But anyway, so they've kind of got a misunderstanding for a lot of the story of each other. Yeah. He's trying to take Marie Joseph's word for it that she's, you know, not a monster, but he sees right. her doing what he thinks of as animal things, and she sees him doing things that she thinks are hurting the one person on this terrible surface world who's listening to her sing, who's clearly sympathetic, yeah. et cetera.
Yeah, and that's the irony, too, that there is some power of healing in mm-hmm. the sea creatures. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there isn't the secret organelle that can be, you know,
right, right. Eaten, maybe that's consumed. Where some of this idea of the sea creatures granting immortality maybe comes from. But, yeah. And often superstitions, there is or was something at the yes. root of it, but people are jumping in the wrong directions with conclusions mm-hmm. and so on. So one of the characters that I haven't talked about before, there's some parallelisms between the sea woman and the woman who becomes known in the story as Odalette.
Yes.
So back on Martinique, Marie-Joseph had a slave who she played with and who helped her with, you know, her and Eve with various things. Named at the time, I'm sorry, Odalette is the name that they knew her as.
It's the name they gave her, yes.
Later, she asserts that, my name is Halita. It's always been Halita, and I'm not going along with this Odalette stuff anymore. Right. Yeah. So there's discussion of colonialism in here, where, you know, colonialism and slavery. And Marie-Joseph yeah. wants to help both of them, but is afraid of doing anything because she's afraid, for instance, that if she frees Halita, who she regards as an equal, but she's afraid that if she frees her, that she'll just starve. That's, in a way, certainly she's sympathetic to a person she cares about, but in a way it infantilizes, you know, her sister, yeah. Halita, who is a smart cookie. She has mm-hmm. managed to make herself popular as a servant at court by doing people's hair in ways that they hadn't thought of before. And, you know, she's clearly some kind of fashion genius. And the ladies at court love her, and they're giving her things. They're giving her pearls. They're getting, you know, so she's doing okay. But Marie-Joseph is so bound up in thinking of my helpless sister, the slave, whom I must help, you know, she doesn't even talk to Halita about freeing her, you know, partly because she doesn't want to raise her hopes, but she doesn't even talk to her as an equal about how can we work this out so I can help you. And yeah. similarly, she wants to help the sea woman, but for a while she doesn't really talk with her frankly about what's going on. And part of that is because Marie-Joseph really, I mean, clues are there early in the book, but she doesn't understand that what the court wants to do, what the king wants to do, is cook the sea woman and eat her, because they've decided that must be how we get more immortality. I mean, it's ridiculous. And, you know, so anyway, there's parallelism there in the situation of yes. these two women, where, you know, they're both people that, you know, Marie-Joseph is one of the only people, certainly at first, to realize these are people.
Yeah. And Halida, and she hits Marie-Joseph with a big truth bomb.
Oh, yeah.
When Marie-Joseph says, "Why would you go back to Turkey? You're just going to end up in a harem." And she says, "How is that better than on Martinique?
Right.
And did you not realize that my mother was part of your father's harem, essentially?
Right.
And that we are actual sisters?
Right.
Did you never put that together?"
Right. Born at the same time. Yeah. Father nowhere to be seen. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was an effective scene. I had forgotten that. I re-listened to the last chapter last night just to refresh on what happened at the end.
Right. So one of the things that Marie-Joseph and the sea woman do that gets at least some sympathy from the common people is the sea woman starts telling Marie-Joseph, when Marie-Joseph can understand her better, the sea woman starts telling her stories of her people, trying to make herself and her people as real, or at least maybe won't be totally forgotten. If she does die. So Marie-Joseph is translating that for people. The king hears one of these stories and asks if she's trying to make her into Scheherazade, who in the Tales of 1001 Arabian Nights, I think, there was a king who kept killing his women, and Scheherazade was a woman who started telling him a story and then kind of ended on a cliffhanger, so he would wait till the next night. And so the king calls her Scheherazade, and Scheherazade can clearly understand human speech. I mean,
yes,
they've been around, they've listened to these sailors talking, and then she's been at court. She's figured out what it all means. And she claims the name best she can say it, Scheherazade. All the mer people to the human people, or to the, you know, to the court and so on, are hideous, ugly gargoyles. And that's part of why they have trouble recognizing them as human, because they have this preconception that ugly is bad. You know, so they're either savage monsters or they're demons.
And they're dark skinned, you know, heaven forfend.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. I was just thinking kind of other color, like green or something like that, but you're right. I think from the description. There's all kinds of reasons that they don't want to be thinking of these people they want to exploit as, you know.
And you get into some of the kind of going back to the positive aspect of religion here, is that Marie-Joseph is arguing, if these are people, it is immoral to kill them.
Yes.
And so, you know, she loves the king and says, if you do this, you are endangering your soul.
Yes. And she takes that very seriously. Marie-Joseph takes the soul very seriously. And she's trying to talk the Pope into, look, you're saying they're godless. Well, maybe nobody's talked to them about, you know, the word of God. Maybe what you need to do is trying to be converting them rather than hounding them all to death and all of that. I could talk now about some of the differences I noticed from the original book, or is there anything else you'd like to talk about first?
I mean, I wanted to talk just a little bit about, there's also sort of a metaphor of exploiting the natural world.
Oh, right? Yes. Where
you could see the sea people. It reminds me of The Snow Queen by Joan Vinge, because it's literally hunting sea people and extracting something from them for immortality.
Right.
And so it's a kind of a similar thing. I don't remember whether, I think, this book is later than The Snow Queen. The Snow Queen was 1979. So.
Okay. All right. I mean, certainly people have been aware of issues with colonialism for a long time. I do think that's something that, you know, she was putting in there. Again, without making it preachy, You know, there are certainly characters who are arguing with each other over politics and theology, but you don't have long info dump sessions. McIntyre is writing to an audience that she expects has some knowledge of this, you know.
Sure.
And again, I started appreciating it more after, you know, my post Three Musketeers knowledge, where, you know, I've been listening. I mean, for one thing, I just, you know, have read more in general. But with some of the other reading I've been doing, so, a lot of podcast listening. We talked about Emmanuel Dubois, Lafayette We Are Here podcast. I listened to the whole entire Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast, which had so much French history in it. I mean, it starts hundreds of years before the French Revolution, because he's trying to explain how everyone had, you know, France had a lot of money, but they kept spending it. And the kings would get some more, but they'd expect their ministers to do the impossible. And that's a big element in this story. The king doesn't have money because he's been burning all his money away on campaigns, not against just the Huguenots, but certainly them. And also, you know, basically doing a lot of things. And one of the things Emmanuel points out is by the end of his reign, Louis XIV's people had a lower standard of living than before because he'd spent them into so much debt. And so Mike Duncan talks about how king after king leading up to Louis the 16th, but certainly including the 13th and 14th, had ministers who tried to do something to get the economy on a better keel, and the kings would just keep overruling them. The money has to be somewhere. Just find it. You know, and this is like, I mean, you could compare it to Game of Thrones, where, you know, the king just wanted to go off on these super expensive royal hunts. And he just thought of all that stupid stuff about money as paperwork. And that's not, you know, that's just something some accountant has to figure out for me. and it's a common element in monarchy. I mean,
all I can think of is there's always money in the banana stand.
Yes. Well, right. So that's one of the things that's going on here. And those podcasts gave me a better understanding of kind of the economics leading into things that are going on in this book, with the king being desperate for money.
And that's the other side of the 1001 Nights analogy, where Scheherazade ends up with a stay of execution because she's leading them to sunken treasure.
That's right. Our sea woman has seen lots of sunken ships, and she knows where they are, and she knows where there's gold, and their people would, you know, pick up pretty rings for a while and then drop them into the depths because there were always more. You know, they could always pick up more because there were so many. And so she's trying to bargain for her life with the king that, you know, I'll show you where there's some treasure if you'll just let me go. Getting us – go ahead.
Well, before we – I know you want to talk about differences.
No, that's fine.
I do want to talk a little bit about the ending, and the ending that the king makes for people he clearly loves but understands that they need to go away now, where he's able to essentially give them all what they want.
But makes it sound like a punishment.
Right. Though it's not great for Count Lucien until the sea people show up with a bunch of riches for him.
So Lucien helps Marie-Joseph, and by that time, Eve. try to help free the sea woman. And so, of course, the king views this as a betrayal because, you know, he keeps hoping that if he can just eat the sea woman, he'll live forever. And even if it won't help him, he'll be showing dominance over the sea people. Yeah. And it's very important to Louis to continually be showing dominance. In real life, his uncle tried to raise a coup against him and got a lot of the nobles to go along with him. Yeah. And now he's old and feeble. So he's constantly feeling like he has to do these shows of strength. And conquering the sea people, you know, is one more thing he's got in his head that he has to do to make himself safe. So one of the differences I noticed, Seth, was in this current book, there's a lot it happens over and over again where the sea woman's going to get away and then something goes wrong. And there's less of that in the first book, in the edition that I read. Okay. So to me, it felt like, oh, it's not dramatic enough. So we've got to insert all this fake drama, herky jerky back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it just makes by the end, it's similar again, but there's all this stuff in the middle that is, in the last third of it that I think overly complicated it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can certainly believe the king would go back on his word. Sure. You know, he's clearly done lots of things in, you know, his life that he thinks are bad, but he did them anyway because he thought they were necessary. And so I liked the ending of the book well enough. Mm-hmm. One of the big differences in the book, I don't know at all if they did this in the movie, is by the end of the book, so Scheherazade has gotten away. She's told her people all about what's happened, and that the land people may be hunting them down and trying to eat them all. And so the sea people have started fashioning weapons, and they are stopping ships, and they are using their amazing diaphragm sonar powers to
crack open the bottoms of
ships. Crack open the bottoms of the ships. And so it's pretty clear there's going to be a sea war. And Lucien and Marie-Joseph are happy on their little island, more or less, but in exile, but there's going to be a sea land war, you know, so that's not what happens in the original book. Okay. I mean, clearly she's upset, but because it's actually Marie-Joseph who managed to get her free in the book, she kind of is willing to write the whole thing off as a really bad time. Mm-hmm. And not go to war against Marie-Joseph's people. Mm. So, you know, of course, the ending in the second version is, possibly sequel country, for another book. I think the other major difference that I noted was the first couple of pages with Eve on the boat where they're capturing the sea monsters. I don't remember that. So I think it was a good idea in many ways because otherwise you don't see him for quite a while in the book, and you get to see earlier, you know, that he's a scientist, that he's excited, that he's, you know, he's worked hard for this. Mm-hmm. And so in a way it makes him more sympathetic, but you know, I do wonder what else got changed in the book without me doing
do a line-by-line comparison.
Yes, yes, that would be a bit of work. One other difference that I remember is that in the original version, Marie-Joseph, so there's a couple of times when she composes for the king. Mm-hmm. And in one of them, she's brought in some Asiatic, like where their keys are next to each other on a keyboard, instead of playing a third, you know, you'll play a second and that kind of thing, using some of the Asian tones in Asian music, something that she heard at some point, maybe from people who were stopping by Martinique for some reason. I don't know. Anyway, she's got some knowledge of this and she puts it into one of her things. And the Pope, you know, as much as he in this book doesn't like her being heard and making her music heard and all of that, he really, really doesn't like dragging in this pagan Asiatic stuff.
Well, she was putting backmasking in her music as well.
So I just, there is some music in this, not, it doesn't go a lot into composition theory, for instance, but there's stuff going on that anyone who has had much musical education, you know, can understand better what she's doing.
Yeah.
And in this version of the story, she's kind of taking music wholesale from Scheherazade, whereas in the original book, Marie-Joseph has more skills of her own. Mm. In the second version of the book, she composes a whole opera while she's also trying to take care of the sea woman and trying to sketch and help her brother and do the woman who she's supposed to be taking care of at court, her hair, you know, or arranging, you know, Yeah. It's ridiculous. Nobody can write an opera while all that is going on. Right. I find myself a little frustrated with the second version of the book. Mm. I still think it's really interesting, and yeah. I'm glad that you found it also of some interest.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. Are you familiar with the origins of the book? In the audiobook that I listened to, there was a long afterword.
So I'm aware that she and Ursula K. Le Guin collaborated on a project that was written sort of like we've seen some more fiction written since then, where it's written as though it's a scientific journal.
Right.
Encyclopedia. Right. And so they wrote something called, I think something like The Origins and Decline of the Sea People or something yeah. like that, where Ursula K. Le Guin sketched mm-hmm. and Vonda McIntyre wrote it, I think. So that was interesting. I didn't know that when I read the book the first time. I didn't know that much too. I had probably heard of Ursula K. Le Guin, but yeah. you know, I know more now. Mm-hmm. I think that's how it started.
Yeah. It's interesting too that then she adapted it for a screenplay years and years ago, essentially adapting the encyclopedia entry into a screenplay that I think became the novel. And, you know, she talked about the lesson that she learned about screenplay is don't hold your breath. and certainly when don't hold your breath is a good one for a novel with water breathing characters.
Right. They didn't really have good enough tech to show that yeah. at that time.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, with the movie called The King's Daughter is, mm-hmm. is that it was filmed and completed in 2014 and then yeah. was in development hell, even though it was essentially in the can. It reminds right. me of the Batwoman movie or Batgirl
yeah.
movie.
Recently. Yeah, I think it's one of those things where studio execs didn't have faith in it, so they didn't want to even put the money into a theatrical release.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I guess 2022, still in pandemic fever, you know, well, what do we have in the can that yeah. we can
we
pull
scrape
out?
A few dollars
I think
out
that's
it.
I think that's how it got put out in yeah. 2022.
So I watched it yesterday. It's available mm-hmm. on Amazon Freevee.
Okay.
And it's not very good. I will say it's like somebody wanted to make a Disney princess movie out of this.
Right.
Complete with the music. It has much more contemporary music in it. The costuming looks like the costuming would be in an animated film. I kind of respect that they did not try for any kind of authenticity in the makeup and costuming because it just doesn't look anything.
I mean, I enjoyed Moulin Rouge, mm-hmm. which, you know, is set in old Paris, but has pop tunes and so on. You yeah. know, Baz Luhrmann did that one. I can enjoy that approach. Mm-hmm. But in the movie, did they also have King Louis sail on the ship?
I think
that
he did.
That was another yeah. thing that, okay, that was another thing that bothered me about the second version. Mm. Here's this old gouty king,
yes,
who's worried about his kingdom, you know, slipping away or being torn away from him, and there's the idea that he goes off on a sea journey, which would have been months,
yeah,
to go, you know, and it just seemed a little, it seemed right. and, ludicrous
and,
to me. Know,
in the movie, he's played by Pierce Brosnan, and
sure,
he looks much healthier than.
Right. He doesn't look like someone who's tottering around. And I mean, of course, King Louis XIV, you know, even near the end of his days, he would marshal all his strength to look strong and yeah. healthy. And then, you know, he'd be limping around in his private quarters and yeah. so on. True. But, you know, but yeah.
And at the time of the filming, you know, Pierce Brosnan's in his mid to early 60s or early to mid 60s. Mm-hmm. And,
right.
You know, but he looks much healthier. And
yeah.
the movie drastically simplifies things. There is no Count Lucien. There's a love interest who's the ship captain, Yves Delacroix.
Thank you.
They turn it a little incestuous because, of course, they're not brother and sister, and she is the king's daughter. And so it's very strange. But the weird thing is the places where there's these pop music beats is mm-hmm. in a Disney movie, I expect one of the characters to be singing, but in, you know, usually it's just the character is looking wistfully off into the distance and the singing is going
right.
on. So it's,
right.
I don't, it's not, it's
right.
not.
Now you have me thinking about Lady Hawk, which I think used its music very well.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, the opening is startling to people
yes.
who were expecting it to be harpsichord music or something mm-hmm. to begin yeah. with, but
so I will say it's not a disaster, the movie, it's just mm-hmm. it's just not very good, and it's
Yeah, so definitely don't judge the book by the movie. Don't even judge the second version of the book by the movie.
So that's the little 3-minute Take Me to Your Reader episode on this book.
Thank you, yes.
I won't inflict it on my co-hosts. Oh, interesting. It was the last released movie of William Hurt's career. It wasn't the last one that he did because it was filmed in 2014.
Does he play the Pope in the movie or just some priest?
A priest.
Yeah, so they strip out the Pope as well.
Yeah, they did. They did. And he serves the same role in many ways, but he's more of a good guy. And he's more just the king's confessor. Mm-hmm. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention was the interesting kind of historical tidbit was what an event the king waking up in the morning was.
Oh, yeah.
That was fascinating.
That was, and I think that was correct. There's absolutely a historical record of people who were of royalty or even very high nobility, they would allow certain people into, in the women's cases, boudoirs, and in the king's case, I don't know if they had a special name for it, but there were definitely things, the way the whole thing was staged, where he had been sleeping with his mistress, and then he wakes up at like 5 to go to his quote bedroom and lay under the covers or on the covers or something. And that's where the nobles that are in his, closest court troop in to witness. Yeah. So that was one of the things about this book, Seth, looking at how much time they had to spend giving fealty to the king.
Yes.
Being there, watching him wake up, being respectful, trying to ask for things, but trying not to be too pushy, mm-hmm. Because you don't want the king annoyed at you for asking all the time.
And I wondered, too, if the nickname, the Sun King, if that was mm-hmm. part of it with which, the sun rises when the king rises, right?
Right.
The day doesn't start until the king's up.
Right. I mean, in his youth, so Louis XIV, father died when he was young. Mother became his, the regent. And I think Cardinal Mazarin was helping her at that time. Anyway, Louis XIV, as he's growing up, and I mentioned his uncle trying to take over and so on. Louis XIV in his youth was a gorgeous young man. Mm. And he was a ballet dancer. He would dance ballet just to show how much better he was than everyone else, mm-hmm. It was part of his whole power and magnetism, and people remembered his beauty and vigor years and years and years and years later. But he used everything he had, and he made people fall into line by, oh, if you don't want to come to my room in the morning, well, I guess I don't have any time for you at all.
Right.
So he was taking everyone's time all the time. So, Eve, who wants to do science, is frustrated, almost beyond endurance because he just wants to do his science, but he's having to stay at court. He's being assaulted by ladies who think it's all a game, even though he's a priest and his priest robes, in some way should protect him. Life at court, I would hate it. I would hate it. I would hate it.
Well, just the bits about him trying to do the dissection, right? And all that. And he has to do it with an audience. And we can watch this for an hour or so, and then we'll postpone it till tomorrow. And we're like, we don't have a freezer.
Just shove some ice on top of the thing. The trials of being even scientists today have many trials in trying to get sponsors and funding. Yeah. But I don't think many of them have sponsors who say, I'm tired, I'm not into it today, I'll come back in a couple of days, just keep the body on ice till then. I don't think many scientists have that level of disruption going on to their work.
I think I've come to the end of my notes. I know that you had extensive notes, so if you have anything else you want to talk
about. So I have a couple more comps to talk about.
Okay.
So we've mentioned Kuhn's Structures of Scientific Revolution. We've mentioned Martine's Memory Called Empire. I wanted to mention The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin. It's the 50th anniversary of that story. Mm. And I think, the ethical struggles that Marie has of being in a corrupt system and everyone around her thinks she's just a fool for doing anything but trying to have the king's favor. Mm-hmm. And here we are in a society that's profiting from other people's suffering. That's all very ones who walk away from Omalas. And in the end, she exiles herself. She walks away, or she is exiled. Anyway, that one. And I also want to talk about another book by C.J. Cherry, 40,000 in Gehenna. This is not one of her books that won a lot of awards, but I read it also probably 20 years ago and thought it really had a lot to it. In that, there's a lost colony, essentially, and some scientists come to look at it. There's still some people on this lost colony world, and some of them have made different kind of relationships with some lizards. Big lizards. And in this, there's a lot of discussion of science and bias as well. Again, discussion meaning like McIntyre does it, where you see what's happening and you see the science and you see the bias. There's a woman anthropologist who's studying some people, and the leader of that group is a woman, and the anthropologist, she's written off as being biased because she's a woman. The queen's a woman. Obviously, she's too sympathetic. Whereas the man scientist who's studying a male-led colony and accepting the slave women the king gives him, etc., he's not biased.
Right. Yeah.
and that's only part of the story of the book. But you know, I am not running down science. I think that science is important, that science done right can lead us to better knowledge, can lead us to developments, can lead us to medicine, etc. But if we try to pretend it's on some pedestal, that can only do us all harm. There is bias when you're looking at something. You have to have some kind of framework when you're looking at something to make sense of it. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just all a Jackson Pollock, splatter painting of data, and you don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
There are probably people out there who make more sense of Jackson Pollock paintings than I do. But anyway, you have to have some kind of framework, but sometimes they'll give you blinders. And sometimes you're wearing blinders that you don't need at all, as in sexism and racism and so on, that just make you discount things that are important. Yeah. So anyway, 40,000 in Gehenna, I like that book. And if you're interested in this topic of science, there's definitely some going on in there. C.J. Cherry's definitely another person who's interested in how beliefs shape people's behavior and science and sociology, anthropology, etc. And I did have a big references section where I had saved. I looked up pronunciations, and I hope I said them all reasonably well.
You've already shared the document for me, so I'll make sure to include those references.
Yeah. I did my best with the pronunciations. I have not. I had maybe half a semester of French in high school, and that's it. I went on to German instead.
Yeah, I had 4 years of German, so.
Yeah. We had a good German teacher, and I thought he was a better teacher than a French teacher. And so what are you going to do? My sister took Latin.
Nice.
And so anyway, that was what I wanted to talk about. Thank you so much, Seth, for letting me talk about this book that I'm so interested in, that I'd like more people to know about, even with some caveats.
Yeah. And, by way of final thoughts for me, I thought this was a lot of fun. I thought it was, I did this one on audio. My audiobook hold from the library expired right at the same time as my ebook came through. So I just picked right up where I was and kept on going.
How convenient.
And then 2 days later, my additional hold on the audiobook came back through. And so I just picked up actually where I had left off in the audiobook. So those couple of chapters in the middle I read twice. But it was an excellent audiobook, actually. I think that it was a good character differentiation. You always knew when it was Count Lucien.
Was it speaking. A cast of readers or a single reader?
It was a single narrator, but she did a really good job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're wrapped here, Sarah. So thank you again for being a regular contributor to the podcast.
You're welcome. I I do like this podcast a lot. I like the conversations and the, you know, the care and attention people have for the developments in the book. It seems like that's not something you find in every review discussion, and I appreciate it here.
Cool. Well, thanks for contributing to it this time. So where can people find you these days?
Oh, these days I'm mostly public on Mastodon. And those addresses are always a little harder for, you know, I mean, I'm still at Configures on Twitter, but I'm really not doing much there these days. Certainly less than I used to. I will send you my Mastodon link if you want to put it in the show notes.
Yeah, sounds good. And I'll make sure.
I mean, I'm Configures there too, but there's a whole prefix to that, blah, blah. So,
yeah. The level of effort that I'm willing to give to social media is quite low. And so I tend to go on inertia. And so, you know, I still occasionally check Facebook and I still log into Twitter hoping that it will go back to being what it used to be. And so I have a Mastodon account, I have a Blue Sky account, but I'm not doing everything I probably should be doing to try to gather the same community in those places.
Well, I promote you from time to time on Mastodon just because I think more people should know about you. I have seen that you're not that active there.
All right. Well, Sarah, thanks again, and I'm sure we'll do this again sometime.
Thanks, Seth.
Okay, bye.
The theme music for the Who Goes There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.